It's time for our Friday interview this week. It's with the broadcaster Liz Kershaw, who's presented Top 40 on Radio 1, fought the Save Radio 6 music, and also made claims about being routinely groped while working at the BBC. She described the atmosphere at Radio 1 as intimidating for a young woman. She's now serialised her life in her autobiography, The Bird and the Babe, The Facts of a Life at the BBC. She began by telling me about how she started out in the media.
I just happened to be at a gig one night and I met somebody from the Yorkshire Post who was reviewing it, and we got chatting, and he said to me, oh, you know, you seem to know what you're talking about. So, yeah, that was my first foray into the media, and it was a weekly column. And so that my boss at BT didn't know what I was up to, I used my false name, a showbiz name, Dawn Chorus, and I got away with it for a while.
What were you doing for BT?
Oh, I was some kind of, I can't remember the exact title, I was some kind of management, marketing and PR executive. So I organised exhibitions, I wrote the staff newspaper, I placed advertisements. It was a real grown-up, sensible and well-paid job.
And meanwhile, you're taking the pee, calling yourself Dawn Chorus. You're winding it up.
No, I did have a secret other life, yeah.
And were you single-minded? Did you have a vision for what you wanted to do? Your career to be?
No, I had no idea. I just knew that there was more to life than being in that office and looking at the clock. I knew that I wasn't happy, and I know that many, many people aren't happy, but they, you know, they go to work and they earn a living and they keep the families. But I just thought, is there an escape route from this whereby I could do something I really enjoyed and get paid for it at the same time? But I didn't know what. And then by chance, I walked into Radio Leeds to sell them a new switchboard, and they decided for me.
You were selling them a new switchboard?
Yeah, my job at Radio at BT was to get people to make more use of the telephone network, our subscribers, as they were called then. And in those days, I'm sure you remember, people had a phone in the hall and it was hardwired, and they probably had a table that they specially bought for it.
Yeah.
Not usually a chair, because they didn't spend much time on the phone. It was just seen as a necessity.
Do you know, you're bringing me back to my childhood, and I'm sorry to go off on a tangent, but I'm going to, right?
Go on.
Because you've just brought this picture into my head. I remember when I was a little boy, that phone sitting in the hall, exactly as you describe, with a little table. And it was the dial with the circles in it, right?
Yeah.
No push button. And there was a 3-digit number. Now, this was Northern Ireland. I'm sure it was the same across the UK. There was a 3-digit number that you could phone, and it made the phone ring back. And when I got into my teenage years, I found out what that number was. And of course, my mum and dad didn't allow me to use the phone in case I was running up huge bills. So I would phone that number, pretend somebody was ringing me, answer the phone and sit on the phone to my mates for hours on end. Now, that's me off on a tangent. Sorry, back to Radio.
No, that's what life was like. And that was why I was in a job at BT, because I remember my dad saying, get off that phone.
That's right.
You know, don't make a phone call unless it's absolutely necessary. So people had phones, but they didn't really pay much. So my job was to get people to use them more. So one day I came up with a cunning plan, because I had a fixed budget for advertising. And I thought, what if I got all the radio stations across Yorkshire to start using the phones more? Not only would it run up people's bills, it would also signal that it was a cool thing to do. So I set off going around all the radio stations to sell them the latest technology, which included a digital switchboard. And it was while I was in full flow at Radio Leeds that the guy behind the desk, who was the editor of the station, was like Mr. Burns on The Simpsons. And he said, stop there, young lady. You seem like a lively young girl. Do you know anything about pop music? And I said, well, actually, I do, because I write a column. And he said, right, I'm looking for young people. And I learnt later that it had a message from above saying, our audience is literally dying off, so can you get some young people involved and reduce the average age of the audience? And I happened to walk in just at the right time. So he said, you'll have to do a voice test. Well, I can't remember that ever happening, and I wouldn't have passed it because, you know, to people in Leeds, I sound very alien. But anyway, I started a few weeks later on a Wednesday night with a show called On the Rocks with Liz Kershaw on Radio Leeds, where others follow.
And did you see the Beeb at that stage as the be-all and end-all? Were you mesmerised by the BBC?
I was. I'd been mesmerised since I'd been sitting in my high chair listening to the radio with my mum rolling pastry and rolling around to Kenneth Horne, Beyond Our Ken, or Two-Way Family Favourites or Children's Favourites, or when we went out in the car and she'd have a radio on the dashboard and it was on all the time. My mum introduced me to radio because she'd spent a week's wages on a little tranny. And yeah, the BBC was from London and I thought you were born in a special maternity unit when I started to think about it. And people like Tony Blackburn and Johnny Walker, where had they come from? Or my heroine, Annie Nightingale. It never occurred to me that one day I'd be walking in there and even more than that, I'd one day be presenting on the BBC. Not in a million years.
You were also on air on October the 29th, 2011. When news broke of the death of Sir Jimmy Savile, who at the time was still a much-loved television presenter. Let's have a listen to what you had to say that day.
Just before we go, we heard in the news that Jimmy Savile had died. And it's really surreal that, you know, people like that who I'd listened to on the radio, suddenly they were my colleagues because I got this job at Radio 1. And it was very daunting. But I'm so thrilled that, you know, we overlapped with people like that. I've got so many stories to tell. And one day I will. You know, weird things went on.
Now, given what we know now, did anyone pull you about those comments on air at the time?
No, nobody ever asked me what I was on about, no. I really didn't. That day, I was under pressure to pay tribute. So many times over the last 30 years that I've been at the BBC, somebody's come running into the studio and saying, you know, so-and-so's died. And as you know, there are procedures to follow. Or if it's a pop star, you say something nice and play a record. And I thought, I really don't want to canonise this guy on air because one day all this will come out and I don't want to be a hypocrite and I don't want to have egg on my face.
How well did you know him?
I didn't know him well and I didn't know anything about him. What I knew were everybody, were people laughing in the pub when I was at Radio 1, regaling each other with stories of him out and about in the name of Radio 1 and pulling young girls out of the crowd and taking them into his camper van after. And all the jokes about that. Also, I was warned not to cross him because he had some very dangerous gangster friends. And I was also told that he wasn't the great altruistic charity worker that he portrayed himself to be. Yes, he did raise millions, but he also, if you look at the pictures, was covered in brands. And he was making a lot of money himself. So basically the message I was given when I arrived at Radio 1 was steer clear of him. He's a nasty piece of work.
And were you given that with the benefit of hindsight? And I stress that because it's so easy now to say, why didn't you raise it? Why didn't you? But was it all rumour at that stage?
Well, when I was told about him taking girls into the caravan, etc., I didn't realise they were underage. I knew they were young. The joke was they were young teenagers. I thought they were, you know, it didn't occur to me. But I thought that was horrible anyway, because if you're a late 40s man and you're taking 16-year-olds out of a crowd at a BBC event, that's power and exploitation and rather tasteless and dodgy. I didn't know anything to report. I was just told to stay away from him. And I heard the jokes. And I heard people laughing and clinking glasses. And I just felt on the day that it would be really unwise to sanctify the man.
And, of course, the major investigation launched after his death within the BBC, and we've seen all the copy and all the commentary around that. And it was around that time that you began to talk about the culture at the BBC at the time. And you said that you were groped by a man within the corporation too. How did he get away with it?
Because it was a joke. It was laughed off. Jokes were made about it because, as I've said so many times, it was like walking into a rugby club locker room. There were 25 male DJs and 4 women DJs. And I'm not saying that was an exclusive culture at Radio 1. I think it was an exclusive culture within BBC Radio. I think it was also prevalent in BBC Light Entertainment, which made Top of the Pops. But where, you know, when I worked for Five Live, I used to socialise a lot with football teams. And you'd see, a big gang of blokes together who were highly paid superstars. And girls are throwing themselves at them, and you'll get bad behaviour, and you won't perhaps get the best behaviour. And I liken it to that, really.
And when it happened to you, were you tempted to go to the police?
No, I don't see it as a criminal act, and I'll tell you why. Because I don't think it was a sexual act. It was all about reminding me of my place, and it was all about undermining me on the radio.
But you did put in a complaint, didn't you? You say this in your autobiography.
Yeah, I did. I said, I'm sick of this guy coming in and doing that. It's really
And what was the BBC's response at the time? This was after it happened. Shortly after it happened, you complained to BBC management, right?
Well, I got sick of it happening. It was like, oh, no, not again. And it said, what's wrong with you, Liz? Are you a lesbian? So I thought, oh, crikey.
Management within the BBC said that to you?
Yeah, a manager, yeah.
Does that manager still work for the BBC?
No, no. I didn't see it as a sexual overture in any way. It was simply to remind me that, hey, you're a bird. You shouldn't, the insinuation, you shouldn't really be on the air. You shouldn't really be doing this, should you, love? So just to put me off my stride and unnerve me, really.
And how did
Which
you
it did to some extent, you know.
And, how did and you feel, was, Liz, when you got that response from that BBC manager?
I just thought, oh, please. Right, OK, Liz, get on with it. If you want to survive here in this jungle, then grit your teeth, be one of the lads, and just know that's par for the course. But I didn't think it was right. And, you know, there were certain people there that I did find... Well, they set out to make you feel uncomfortable.
The then Director General of the BBC, when all of the... This is post-Savile, was kicking off. The then Director General was George Entwistle, and he asked to see you in his office. So completely different context now when he was looking at these allegations about anybody in the BBC, including what you had said. What was it like when he called you into the office, and how seriously did he take it?
I had actually a lot of time for him. That's the only occasion I met him. And obviously it's quite daunting to be led into the Director General's office. It only came about because I'd been invited. I'd been telling people since 1989. Sorry, 89, yeah. But suddenly everybody wants to know about it. And I was a bit bemused, really. But anyway, it came about because I was asked to go on the Today programme to talk about Jimmy Savile. And I said, I can't do that. Oh, well, can you talk about the culture that might have allowed him to operate? So I said, yeah, I can do. So I did that. And then all hell's let loose. So I'm led into the Director General's office. I really respected him. I really liked him.
And so finally, some 20 years after this had happened to you, someone was taking it seriously.
More 20-odd years. Well, it's not just about me, Stephen. It's what I was saying, really, was... Yeah, okay, so somebody stuck their hands up my jumper, but there's only one woman doing a breakfast show on BBC Radio. So, hello, there's still something not right about the way women are viewed in this organisation, George, if you don't mind me saying so.
You refused, because he asked you who did it. He asked you to name the person and you refused to do so.
Yeah.
Why protect him?
I'm protecting myself. I suppose I was protecting myself as well, because I had no proof, and... therefore, I wasn't going to say something I couldn't prove. I believe that's, why we have civil law and libel law. But also, my motivation wasn't to punish or go after a man for something he'd done 20 odd years earlier, which...
But he had sexually assaulted you, Liz.
No, it wasn't sexual assault.
Well, someone sticks their hand up your jumper.
Yeah, I've tried to explain to me, though, it wasn't a sexually motivated assault and it certainly didn't feel sexual to me. It was just bullying in a personal way, which he'd done because I was female and I had breasts. But I'd moved on 25 years later. I just wanted to enlighten him, because I'd been asked to do so, about what the culture was like when Jimmy Savile was running amok.
You know...
And I didn't want to pick on an individual.
You know that man, Liz, is very, very lucky, because had you have taken a different tack, he would probably be in court, charged with sexual assault.
He will get his comeuppance one day. I think, literally... You can liken it to a witch hunt. If you think that in the times of the witch hunts in this country or in North America, Salem, you could simply say, I accuse my neighbour or I denounce somebody, and you don't have to have any proof, then that is a witch hunt. For instance, my somebody very close to me witnessed a murder. And so I firsthand saw the process of that. First of all, if it's a murder or a burglary, you have to establish that a crime has actually been committed with physical evidence. Then you have to find a perpetrator, and then you have to prove with CCTV, DNA, eyewitness accounts, circumstantial evidence, the lot, that that person is guilty. I've experienced that firsthand. What Operation Yew Tree said to me was, oh, we don't necessarily need anything like that. Don't worry about it.
So actually, you're calling into question the integrity of the Operation Yew Tree process.
Not the integrity of the officers. I'm calling to question the wisdom of the Crown Prosecution Service to drag women who I utterly believe have been assaulted into a court with no proof, putting them through that, and then their assailant walking out. What happens to those women now? They're left high and dry.
Well, Liz, there are ups and downs in any career. And you've also written in your book about an incident involving a former colleague who went on to commit suicide. Absolute tragedy. Why did you write about it in your book?
The reason I put this incident in my book was because I've tried to be very honest in my book about the life of Ad at the BBC. And I've read so many autobiographies which have been sanitised, and I really didn't want mine to be like that. And also, I'd fought so hard in my contract to get rid of the gagging clauses that have stopped me writing a book for the past 5 or 6 years, which said you couldn't talk about the BBC or its programmes, its affairs, blah, blah, blah.
That's so taking on the BBC. That's a big thing to do.
Well, I was told I couldn't write my book in 2007 unless the management vetted it word by word and actually could censor some stuff that I put in. So a couple of years ago, I refused to sign my contract and I went in for 6 months without being paid because I wouldn't sign up to these, what I call gagging clauses. Anyway, it's cut a long story short, Tony Hall, he announced last year, I'm not having gagging clauses in my contracts and I want all BBC contracts, the gagging clauses to be taken out. I want people at the BBC to be able to speak openly about their experiences of working there so we can all learn from it. So having fought that, I then thought, right, well, I've got the green light now for a candid autobiography, so it would be hypocritical for me to be self-censoring. So that's why I put in a very tragic episode in my life in local radio.
Can I ask you about when we were talking there about the BBC? Because I really should have asked you, do you think the culture has changed now?
I've never experienced a culture like that since Radio 1. From Radio 1, I went to Radio 5 before it became 5 Live. And there were a lot of women there working as producers and in all roles in production and management. The controller was a woman, and it was a completely different culture, to the extent that I felt quite sorry for some of the guys there because they were a bit henpecked. And then I went to 5 Live, which I was, you know, really pleased because they shut down the old 5, and I was one of the people who Jenny Abramsky took on for a new station. So, you know, I'm pleased it's done so well. And And she was a formidable woman, Jenny Abramski, a real matriarch. And there was, you know, there was no suggestion of any sort of sexism or that old-fashioned 70s disco culture or pirate ships or swinging 60s London there. And I've never experienced it in my 12 years at Six Music or in BBC local radio in the workplace. That culture of rampant sexism, it was unique to Radio 1 in my 30 years at the BBC.
And let's talk about Five Live then. You've seen and heard the station evolve over the years. How do you reckon the change has gone down? For the better or not? And you can be honest.
Oh, yeah. I think, it was put together in a hurry. That's as a matter of record. I think it was on for a few weeks initially, and then they said, hey, this is really good. Can you put a full-blown station together, Jenny? And it was done quite on the hoof. And fortunately, very last minute, they found Jane Garvey and BBC Local Radio and took her down to present The Breakfast Show and Peter Allen and Adrian Charles. And, you know, and we were off, hitting the ground running. But, you know, we were experimenting and finding our feet and what worked and what didn't work. I think it's a much more polished and focused product now. And I say in my book, you know, stations like Five, Radio 2, Radio 4, Six Music, they're the best radio stations in the world. They're the envy of the world. And I know that because I've been around the world and people tell me that, and that gives the BBC its unique brand position.
And yet here we are at the time of doing this interview, with more copy, more news headlines about that the BBC should have its way, it's been funded, the licence fee removed. The BBC has been battered over the last couple of years. And I just wonder how much the BBC deserves and how much people forget what the BBC does well and whether we are good within this organisation as to putting the front foot first and saying, do you know what? Let us tell you what we are actually doing well in this organisation.
Well, have you got a handy copy of Land of Hope and Glory? Because now's your time to put it on. I think the BBC is easy to attack. And I'm speaking as a licence payer as well now, because I do also pay my licence and my son's. It's easy to attack because we own it. So, you know, it's out at those closest to you. And so we feel we have a right to criticise it positively and negatively. But I do firmly believe that it's unique and it makes this country unique. And it's the glue that binds this country together. It's part of the fabric of this country.
But do you think the licence fee should go?
No, I do not. I think that's, honestly, when you think that I have to pay £600 a year for Sky Plus, which I don't really think I need, but my sons insist I have it, and the BBC's is less than £150, £3 a week. I'm not just saying that because it pays my wages. I really think that it's short-sighted to think of scrapping the licence fee, and in that way it would change the ownership of the BBC, and people would really miss it if it went. And can I just say, it's the best ambassador that this country has, because it's got me through borders in Africa. People recognise the brand. It's got me into parties. It's got me into royal occasions. But it's such a status brand around the world. And I say you could close embassies, and if people are still gathered around the radio, or they're gathered around the TV, listen to BBC World or World Service, it gives this island nation a standing globally that we could not achieve in any other way. It helps us punch far above our weight. And I think people should really value that. It's the fourth most Googled brand in the world for a good reason. I know there's been some scandalous waste of money. Six-figure salaried directors claiming a £2.40 tram fare to Salford Quays. Directors claiming a £500 handbag on expenses. People slapping each other on the back and giving each other £800,000 payoffs. That's all wrong. Put the money back into programmes and let's get back to the basics and remember what we're all here for. We're here for to public service broadcast, okay. Not line our own pockets.
The broadcaster Liz Kershaw on her autobiography, The Bird and the Babe. Liz, lovely talking to you. Thank you so much for doing so.
Thank you.